Nemoto presents theater for beginners. Aeschylus, Birth of Tragedy. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 45 minutes. Theater for Beginners is your honest doorway into the stage where civilizations learn to think out loud. In each episode, one writer and one living question, why does this still hit us in the chest? You'll meet the architects of drama and comedy from Athens to Edo to London, Aeschylus turning grief into law, Sophocles giving conscience a spine, Euripides dragging the sacred into the kitchen, Aristophanes laughing politics back to its senses, Zemi shaping silence, Shakespeare setting language on fire. You leave each episode with more than a plot. You leave with a tool. How to argue without cheating, how to spot a pretty lie, how to stand your ground without becoming stone. If you've ever felt theater was for other people, this is for you. One clear voice, rich storytelling, scenes you can see in your mind, and the quiet conviction that old plays are not homework, they're field guides for today. He stands at the pivot where ritual becomes literature, where the thunder of drums and the circling of dancers turn into characters with names, guilt, motives, and choices. Before him, the chorus shouted and stamped and called the god into the city. With him, the god is still there, dark, implacable, tremendous. But now human beings step forward and speak in their own voices, and the city leans in to hear them. Aeschylus is less a single author than a change of state. The Greeks already had festivals, hymns, dithyrambs, masks, sacred frenzy. What they did not have until him was this particular fusion of song and argument, of dance and decision, of omen and verdict. He brings on stage a second actor, and with that spare addition, everything alters. The chorus is no longer the whole, but a sea against which two figures can throw their words. Debate becomes possible. The distance between one face and another fills with fate. He writes not to entertain a crowd, but to instruct a city about itself. Yet the instruction is not a sermon. It is blood, breath, and the hard grammar of consequence. To watch Aeschylus for the first time is to feel the air of old worship crackle, and then study into the oxygen of civic thought. His birth near Eleusis around 525 BC, it places him in a neighborhood where mystery was already a word with heat in it. Eleusis, home of the rites that promised a kind of blessedness to initiates in honor of Demeter and Persephone, was a suburb of Aa. Boyhood there meant growing up under the rumor that the world has layers, that bread and grief and harvest and return are more than agriculture. Whether or not he knew the rites as a youth, the sensibility of Eleusis, the sense that suffering can be meaningful, that descent and return is a rhythm written into the soil, pervades his plays. He is also a soldier before he is publicly a poet. He fights at Marathon in 490, stands in the surf of Salamis in 480, likely tastes the iron taste of fear at Plataea. His epitaph will remember him not for his poetry, but for his courage on the day when the barbarians came. He belongs to that generation of Athenians who learned at spear point that a city is not an accident but a discipline, and that discipline must eventually be written down in laws. The tragedies are part of that writing. To understand what he alters, picture the city Dionysia before his influence fully takes hold. Processions, sacrifices, choruses of 50 men singing dithyrambs in honor of Dionysus, the god of wine and ecstasy, and tearing apart and putting back together, of masks and metamorphosis. The chorus is a single creature with many mouths, moving in circles, telling a story around a fire. Aeschylus does not extinguish that fire. He banks it. He sets a hearth around it. He introduces, likely systematizes, the practice of playing a trilogy in one day, three tragedies bound by theme, sometimes by plot, followed by a sadder play to release the tension with goatish laughter. He expands costumes and mass craft so that a person can be larger than life, not only spiritually, but also visibly. Most of all, he adds the second actor, the deuteragonist, an invention so minimal it is almost invisible on paper and so maximal that it creates drama as we know it. Two voices collide before the chorus can absorb the shock. Dialogue appears not as banter, but as moral weather. The chorus remains grave, musical, communal, but it is now a partner and a witness rather than the totality of speech. From that day forward, Athens will argue with itself in public as art. The plays we can still hold in our hands are seven, a fraction of the 70 to 90 he is said to have written. The loss is enormous. The remainder is sufficient to show you what he did. Begin with the boldest historical choice a tragedian ever made. He writes the Persians less than a decade after Salamis and sets it not in Athens among victors, but in Susa among the defeated. There is a queen mother, Atossa, worried for her son. There is an empty palace filled with bad dreams. There is a messenger who arrives with the news of wreckage. There is a king, Xerxes, who returns robe-ripped and mind-shaken, the very image of squandered majesty. The chorus in this play are elders of Persia. The grief is theirs. The moral is not jingoism but geometry. Hubris draws its own sum. Greek audiences sat in their theater and watched their enemies mourn, watched a mother hear that her son's armada has split itself upon Greek cunning and divine limits, watched the shade of Darius rise and deliver the sober truth that a ruler who pushes beyond what is allotted invites the correction of heaven. It is patriotic art precisely because it refuses to flatter. It teaches victory to behave. The messenger speech, the catalog of ships, the panic of narrow waters, the clever trap of the straits, is Homeric in vividness and bureaucratic in detail, the official report electrified. The Persians is not only the earliest surviving tragedy, it is a moral technology. Aeschylus invents empathy for the enemy as a civic instrument. Seven Against Thebes tightens myth to siege and gives the audience the sensation of doom beating against walls. Oedipus is gone. The curse remains. The city hears the drum of seven champions at seven gates, and Eteocles, one of Oedipus's sons, chooses defenders and names fate like a quartermaster. The shields become texts, emblems on bronze that tell you who a man thinks he is, Typhon spewing flame, a warrior climbing a ladder, a sphinx, a man without a mark, and the king answers emblem with assignment, reading threats like a scholar reads a sentence, and matching every boast with a citizen. At the end there is the terrible duet, brother against brother at the seventh gate, the curse cashing itself. Aeschylus choreographs inevitability without boredom. He turns the chorus of Theban women into a pulse of anxiety that the men on stage must answer with action and that the city in the seats must answer with policy. The play ends in a tangle of duty and taboo around burial. Even in this early work, the question is already what to do with inherited rage when law must keep tomorrow from collapsing into yesterday's quarrel. The Suppliants, perhaps the oldest of the survivors, offers a gentler but equally daring spectacle. A chorus of women, the Danaids, daughters of Danaus, arrive in Argos seeking asylum from forced marriage to their Egyptian cousins. The play is almost all chorus. It leans into the pre-Aeschylean world of song even as it invents politics. The king, Pelasgus, does not thunder a monarch's will. He consults his people. A vote is imagined. Asylum is granted. The law is born in a scene of hospitality where force was expected. We see, in embryo, a city learning to decide. The Danaids cling to the altar. The gesture becomes a contract. The chorus, far from being a decoration, are the litigants in a case between kinship and consent. It is astonishing to find, so early in surviving drama, a civic ethic dramatized, the question of whether a community will shelter the vulnerable even when danger follows. Aeschylus is a poet of magnitude and blood. He is also a poet of procedure. Prometheus Bound, whose authorship by Aeschylus is debated across centuries, still belongs spiritually to his house. A god who is also a dissident is chained to a rock at the world's edge. He has given fire and the arts of living to mortal men, and for that generosity Zeus, new ruler, young tyrant, has him hammered to stone. There is no plot in the modern sense. There is a series of visitors and conversations, strength and violence, with Hephaestus doing the dirty work, the chorus of Oceanids arriving to witness, Oceanus himself advising compromise, Io, the tormented girl made a cow by divine lust and jealousy, wandering through the map of myth, Hermes, the slick minister of an offended sovereign, threatening what he cannot persuade. Prometheus refuses to yield because he knows a secret Zeus does not. The future contains a marriage that will topple the tyrant unless he learns to rule differently. The play, whether by Aeschylus or by someone steeped in his ways, dramatizes a theme he made central. Power that cannot hear advice is power that will eventually have to learn by pain. And it gives the audience a god who loves men, a stranger in the pantheon, an aristocrat of compassion nailed to a frontier for the sake of human craft. Whether or not the trilogy ended in reconciliation, as some think Aeschylus would have required, the fragment we have is a furnace of resistance and gift. But it is with the Orestia that Aeschylus becomes not merely foundational, but unsurpassed. Three plays walk a single terrible path from blood revenge to the invention of law. Agamemnon returns from Troy under a sky streaked with omens and a house riven by old crimes. He has sacrificed his daughter Iphigenia for wind at Aulis. He has won a war that taught him what a victory can cost. He brings home Cassandra, a prophetess whose gift is to be right in the wrong room. Clytemnestra has run the city while he was gone and has stewed grief into strategy. The chorus are Argive elders who have stayed behind, who remember the day the ships left, who count the dead like beads. There is the beacon speech, the chain of fires lighting from Ida to Argos, the joy of news. There is the slow dread of recognition that joy has a blade hidden in it. There is Cassandra's shattering performance, the most harrowing dramatic self-immolation without flame. She sees, she says, she knows she will not be believed, and still she speaks. Then the deed. Clytemnestra spreads a crimson carpet that is not only cloth but an argument about pride, persuades her husband to tread upon a fabric fit for gods, lures him into the bath, and kills him with a net and a hammer. She stands over the corpses and speaks like a lawyer and like a storm. Aeschylus gives her words that are iron wrapped in silk. Aegisthus, her lover, appears late, not as the architect, but as the appendage of a woman history will never successfully belittle. The play ends without solace. The house is a crime scene and a throne. The Libation Bearers begins in the Register of Graves. Orestes returns from exile with his friend Pylades to a tomb where a lock of hair becomes a clue. Electra, his sister, meets him in a recognition scene that is tenderness upon terror. Aeschylus bounds his play with the language of oaths and the pressure of oracles. Apollo has commanded the sun to kill his mother and her consort. The old law of blood cries for blood. The chorus of captive women instructs and laments. The deed, when it comes, is bifurcated. Aegisthus dies like a usurper, and then the mother enters. She bears the breast that suckled him, an argument of nature against justice. He hesitates and then is pushed by Pylades' simple reminder of the god's command. The blow falls, and the sound that follows is unlike other cries in Greek tragedy. It is the sound of the old order tearing. Orestes sees the Furies. They are invisible to others. They are absolutely real to him. The play ends not with applause, but with pursuit, a man driven mad by the logic of vengeance that he has just executed. The Eumenides is the strangest and most audacious conclusion in theater. We leave Argos for Delphi and then for Athens. The stage becomes a map of sacred places. Orestes clings to the navel stone in Apollo's temple. The priestess sees a wonder she can barely describe. Apollo himself, whose command caused the mat recite, defends his client with arguments that make half the audience shift in their seats. The Furies arrive, older than gods like Apollo, embodiments of grievances that families carry in their bones. They smell the blood. They call themselves just. They call Apollo a young god who does not understand the old ways. They sleep because the god intoxicates them. They wake furious. The case is transferred to a new court. Athena convenes the Areopagus, a council of citizens, to hear the first murder trial in literature. Witnesses speak. The Furies prosecute. Apollo defends. Orestes stands like a precedent that must be decided. The arguments are cutting. About who is more parent to a child, the mother who nurtures or the father whose seed and form animate, about whether some killings end killing, about whether God can command what breaks a taboo, about whether Athens wants to be the city of vengeance or the city of verdicts. The votes are equal. Athena casts the deciding vote for acquittal and then does a second, more difficult thing. She turns to the Furies and persuades them not to wreck the city. She offers them a home in the soil beneath the hill, a cult, a reverence, a permanent place in the civic body as the kindly ones, the Eumenides, guardians of fertility and oath. The chorus that began as terror ends as blessing. He has written a law into myth, and the law is not merely that courts are better than vendettas. It is that a city must find a way to honor the anger of the injured without letting that anger rule. The founding of the Areopagus is less a legend than a blueprint for containing combustible emotion within institutions that do not humiliate it. Only a veteran of war and a son of Eleusis could write such an ending, mercy without forgetting, order that includes the dark. What makes all this more than fables is the density of the language and the seriousness of the music. Aeschylus writes sentences like cliffs, enormous compound words that feel carved rather than spoken, metaphors that stamp themselves onto the mind. His choruses do not dance around the action. They grind it under their heels until it gives up meanings. In Agamemnon, the elders sing of the yoke strap of necessity that sits on the house. In the Persians, they pour grief like oil. In the Eumenides, the old goddesses chant with a meter that feels as old as the earth's heartbeat. He knows when to let a messenger speak for 100 men. He knows when to put a secret into a woman's mouth and let her cry it out until we are ashamed of having listened. He invents the uses of silence. Cassandra's pause before entering the house is a minute-long argument about fate. The guard's first lines in Agamemnon, lying prone on the palace roof, waiting for a flame, teach you how to hear time. If later tragedians refine character, he refines situation. If they sculpt psychology, he sculpts necessity. The result is not less humane, it is more. He does not tell you why Clytemnestra is the way she is. He shows you what she does and lets the action and its consequences reveal a mind as formidable as any in Athens. He does not render Orestes as a bundle of motives. He renders him as a man trapped between gods and genes, learning that even obedience does not protect you from nightmare. He is also a showman of devices who never lets the device be the point. The echoclima, the rolling platform that can display an interior scene to the outdoor audience, exists to let a body be seen. When Clytemnestra reveals Agamemnon and Cassandra, the mechanism is an instrument of moral shock. The props are arguments. The purple tapestries are not just fabric, but the temptation to act like a god. The net is not just a lethal tool, but a metaphor made linen, the tangle of deceit weaponized. He raises costumes to philosophy. The Persian robes that Xerxes tears are the visible unraveling of overreach. The robes that Agamemnon treads are a rug woven of pride. Masks, too, are more than disguises. They are lenses through which the city can study itself without flinching at a single face. He knows that theater must be bigger than life to show life as it is. He builds an architecture of awe so that small choices can be seen in their true size. There are stories at the edges of his life that fit him because they are like him, blunt and strange. One says he was accused of revealing Eleusinian secrets on stage and had to flee to a sanctuary to avoid being stoned by the pious. He was acquitted on the grounds that he did not know. Another says he died in Sicily when an eagle, mistaking his bald head for a rock, dropped a tortoise upon it. True or not, these anecdotes teach by absurdity. The poet of sacred order nearly killed by piety. the god-haunted dramatist finished by the physics of a hungry bird. What is certain is that he traveled to Sicily to the court of Hieron, that he staged plays there, that he returned to Athens to win victories, that younger men, Sophocles first and then Euripides, took his tools and used them to carve their own worlds. He wins many prizes. He loses some to Sophocles. He returns and wins with the Orestia in 458. He dies, perhaps in Gela, leaving his city a set of instructions written in thunder. Why does he still matter, beyond the footnotes of firsts? Because the questions he taught a city to ask have not retired. What do you do when a wrong done long ago insists on being avenged today? How do you honor grief without appointing grief to govern? What is hubris in states and in families, and how do you notice it before it becomes a math problem with only one answer? How do you build institutions that have room for the old gods, the emotions that keep us human, without letting those gods drive? What do you owe your mother when a command from heaven says otherwise? What happens to a nation that celebrates victory without understanding the cost to itself? Aeschylus stages these questions at sizes that make us honest. He places kings and queens under the same sky as we live under, but he turns up the voltage so our eyes can adjust to the truth. You come away not with a moral to pin to a classroom wall, but with a pressure in your chest that feels like responsibility. If we track the innovations forward, we see that his second actor births Sophocles III, that the exile he gives Orestes breeds the wanderers of Euripides, that the law he writes into Athens is the law that later democracies will pretend to rediscover. He insists the chorus remain a conscience even as it becomes a commentary. Later poets, more cynical, will shrink it, but the memory of a community singing through fear will haunt every stage thereafter. He keeps the gods near. Later ages will translate them into words like necessity, psychology, class, instinct. What remains essential is his conviction that the world has an order that can be discovered and injured, and that injury will be paid for unless transformed by wisdom. He is not a pessimist. He is a gardener of consequences. In his theater, Zeus is not so much a character as a name for the highest pattern, dike. Justice is not a prosecutor, but a path. The arc from the first to the last of the Orestia is the arc of civilization, and if that seems too large a claim, consider how often our headlines repeat the plot of those plays, and how rarely our institutions achieve the grace of that last persuasion beneath the hill. Imagine him on a day of festival, standing under the Acropolis as the procession moves, the smell of sacrifice in the air, the city swelling with visitors from demi and island, the sun glancing off bronze and wet stone. He has actors ready, masks hung on pegs like sleeping faces, a chorus drilled until their steps are a single animal, a set of lines whose cadences have been tested like ship planking. He is about to speak not to courtiers, but to citizens, to farmers, sailors, potters, veterans, women in the shadows, boys about to join the ranks, medics who trade, slaves who listen even when not counted. He will show them Persia at home. He will show them two brothers dying at one gate. He will show them a returning king and a waiting wife. He will show them a youth running from blood and a goddess who decides to build a court rather than a shrine to revenge. And when the day is done, and the satyr play has brought relief, and the votes are counted, and wine is poured, and Athens returns to its ordinary chores, something in the city will have been altered by having imagined itself so intensely in public. That is the miracle he makes routine, the transformation of spectators into citizens by means of art. If you want to understand how a culture explains itself to itself when it is still young enough to be surprised by its own powers, read him slowly. Hear the stamping feet, but also hear the syllogisms inside the songs. Notice how often he puts women at the crux of decision. Clytemnestra as the mind that refuses to be an ornament, Cassandra as the mouth of truth punished for speaking, the Danaids as the chorus that decides whether consent matters. Notice how he mixes tenderness into iron, the lock of hair at a grave as a sign strong enough to carry a plot, Electra's recognition of a footprint as a memory big enough to move the world. Notice how often he lets the stage be a courtroom, and how often he then shows the courtroom becoming, magically, a place for blessing. The Furies do not vanish, they are seated and fed. That is political theology in the shape of a ritual, and no other writer has ever staged it with such economy and heat. He is foundational not because he came first, but because he made firstness mean something. He took the god who dissolves boundaries and used him to build the most civilized boundary of all, the one between personal rage and public justice. He took war and turned it into mourning instead of boasting. He took the old stories and harnessed them to new institutions. He took a chorus of neighbors and made them an organ that can sing terror into law. He took mythic time and adjusted its gears until it ticked in the same cadence as assembly and court. He is not quaint, he is contemporary as long as we are. Wherever a community is tempted to answer hurt with more hurt, he is present. Wherever a judge remembers that verdicts need ritual to stick, he is there. Wherever a city must make a place for old angers so that they do not prowl the streets at night, he has a seat in the room. He also teaches us how tragedy thinks. The common saying, borrowed from later philosophers, is that tragedy produces catharsis, some purgation or clarification of pity and fear. Aeschylus doesn't write that formula in any preface. He enacts it in the body's tempo. Pity rises in you as you watch a human face recognize the scale of what it has done or what it must endure. Fear rises as you realize that your face, under slight alteration of circumstance, could be theirs. But the movement never ends in simple relief. The emotion must be educated into comprehension, or it will return tomorrow untouched. His dramas direct feeling through structures as rigorously proportioned as Doric columns, parodos, episode, stasimen, episode, stasimen, comus, exodos. Within that architecture, he pins the mind to images that carry more weight than argument. In Agamemnon, a steady chain of metaphors binds the house, a yoke placed on a neck, a bit in a horse's mouth, a net that entangles, a wind that becomes a hunger in the fleet, a purple sea torn from its source and dyed by crushed creatures. These images are not decoration. They are definitions of constraint. When Clytemnestra lures her husband to step on purple, the scene is not merely ostentation, but a test of whether a man who has acted like a god will allow himself the symbols of godhead. He fails, and the color follows him into the bath, like a tide. Cassandra's speech pours out like iron filings drawn to a magnet, each line snapping to the next as she names slaughter in a house that smiles. The chorus, men who have stayed, weigh force against prudence until both become terms in a calculus whose answer is grief. Formally, he writes two languages at once, the iambic trimeter of dialogue, the measured ordinary speech of tragedy, and the wild, braided lyric meters of the chorus. The trimeter lets characters argue with the clarity of a law court. The lyric measures let the city sing what prose cannot bear. He can tighten dialogue until it becomes stichomythia, single lines hurled back and forth like javelins, each picking up a word of the last and turning it, drawing meaning the way wrestlers draw breath in the clinch. He can loosen a choral ode until it becomes a weather pattern, with anapests marching like feet and responsions that mirror phrase to phrase so the audience experiences symmetry rather than merely sees it. His diction has been called heavy, compact with compounds like God-hated, blood-drinking, doom-wedded, but that density is how he strikes coins that can purchase dark comprehension. He is not obscure, he is concentrated. When he coins the phrase that later ages abbreviate as learning through suffering, it is not a headline but a law. The Greek compresses experience into a geometry. Misfortune falls, a boundary is crossed, wisdom enters through the bruise. Civilization learns the same way families do, late and at cost. He also knows the danger of pretending that suffering alone is education. His world is not a machine where pain automatically prints truth like a receipt. In the Persians, the sight of Xerxes humbled is not a certificate of Persian wisdom earned. It is a warning to the winner that tomorrow someone will sing the same song over Greek ruins if presumption repeats its math. In the Orestia, pain does not stop the cycle. It accelerates it until someone invents a break. That break is not forgetfulness. A city that forgets wrongs invites new ones. The break is structure, speech rules, assemblies, oaths, votes, the steadying presence of ritual that persuades anger to live with neighbors. Tragedy becomes, at this point, a political art in the literal sense. It fabricates the polis, the shared body, anew. When Athena founds a court, Aeschylus is not writing a myth of origins only. He is demonstrating a posture. He bids the spectator practice going from heat to procedure without losing seriousness. The Furies must be seated and honored. Cases must be heard. This is not the erasure of rage. It is rage domesticated so that it can protect what it used to burn. Audiences in 458 BC could connect that founding scene to arguments being shouted a few blocks away. Only a few years earlier, the Areopagus had been shorn of many of its powers by democratic reformers under Ephialtes. Homicide jurisdiction remained in its hands, but the council's political prestige was contested. To write a play that climaxes with Athena ratifying the Areopagus is to write a play that intervenes in present tense. Does Aeschylus endorse a conservative settlement? Does he revise the institution by inviting the ancient powers, the anger of the harmed, into covenant with a newer, more accountable city? Perhaps both. The stage solution is not nostalgia. It is an incorporation. The council is legitimated because the Furies agree to live under the hill and to bless. And blessing in this theater is not incense. It is rain. The final choral procession imagines fertility flowing from legal health. Grain grows. Marriages thrive. Oaths stick. The political thought is agricultural and exact. Law is for harvests, not arguments. His interest in the female voice is not a modern imposition. He sets women at the hinge of events and lets their intelligence carry the plot's weight. Clytemnestra thinks not only with anger but with strategy. Electra learns to read signs and to act. Cassandra speaks truth into a room predisposed to dismiss her so that her words become a mirror in which the audience sees itself refusing to listen. The Danaids, in the Suppliants, teach an entire city to ask what asylum means when desire and coercion trail it up the beach. Even where the play leans toward political utility, he does not flatten individuals into symbols. Clytemnestra is not the feminine or revenge. She is Clytemnestra, wife, mother, ruler, wronged, terrifyingly articulate. When she bares her breast, Aeschylus compresses the whole problem of kinship and law into a gesture that no argument can untangle without changing its own tone. The poet's mercy to her intelligence does not erase her crimes. It ensures that guilt and tragedy remains complicated enough to be true. Because his work nests individuals in enormous systems, family curses, city laws, divine patterns, later readers sometimes say he is less interested in psychology than Sophocles and Euripides. The comparison is unfair to all three. Aeschylus brings interiority to the surface by enlarging choice until it echoes. He shows how a decision made in private becomes a public weather. Agamemnon's sacrifice of Iphigenia is a scene we do not watch in the surviving text. We hear about it curled inside other speech. The general's prudence snarled in piety, a wind that turns ships into hostages, a father who becomes a priest and finds that priesthood, without wisdom, can be a knife. The man tries to speak as a leader. A leader finds he has learned a language that cannot name a daughter. You can count the line as myth. You can count it as diagnosis. He does not enter the mind with clinical instruments. He reenacts the pressure that distorts a mind until it can only see one door. Stagecraft is never separable from thought. Whatever exact machines the 5th century theater used, cranes, doors, wheeled platforms, he makes them mean. The Echeclima rolls to the threshold not merely to display corpses, but to insist that what happens inside, the house belongs to the eyes of the city. A bath becomes a courtroom exhibit, A queen stands at the proscenium and argues a case with spilled bodies as evidence. The altar in the suppliants is not background. It is an asylum you cannot step over without admitting you reject the god who guards it. In Eumenides, the stones matter. The Omphalos at Delphi is a geometry of the world center, and the Areopagus rock is a civic axis. People walk across these objects and become framed by them. The tourist picture of Athens has a hill. The citizen's picture of Athens has a hill outfitted with speech. The satyrplay, which followed each tragic trilogy, also belongs to his sense of proportions. We have only fragments of his satyr dramas and a title, Proteus, for the missing fourth piece of the Orestia. But even the shadow of the genre tells you something crucial. He believed that human beings cannot carry pure severity for an entire day without damage or distortion. An afterpiece of rough woodland comedy, goatish, musical, indecorous, was not disrespect but medicine. The god being honored is Dionysus, after all. Laughter belongs to his rites as much as terror does. The satyr play reminds the city that bodies are still alive after verdicts and that joy, if excluded from law, will revenge itself in alleys. It is a primitive-seeming art form that performs a sophisticated task, reattuning Apollodes' nervous system after the high voltage of tragedy. His religious thought is typically misdescribed as simple piety. In fact, it shows a ferocious honesty about gods and men. Zeus is supreme in his theater, but Zeus is often a name for the largest pattern the mind can sense, but not domesticate. The Olympians themselves sometimes misrule. Prometheus is punished by a regime still learning how to be lawful. Oracles speak in riddles because the future, even when foreknown, must be entered one step at a time. Aeschylus's theology is less a chart of divinities than an insistence that the cosmos is order, that order can be violated, and that violation will be corrected by forces that do not care about our excuses. Yet correction, in the hands of a god like Athena, can become education. The religion of his plays grows from sacrifice toward statute not because the poet is secular, but because he wants worship to result in justice. He has walked in processions and he has buried friends after war. He knows that a city cannot live on smoke. He insists that piety be measurable in the well-being of households and fields. If you seek his influence, you find it everywhere drama has tried to govern anger. Sophocles will pare the edges and drill deeper into the solitude of a single conscience. Euripides will pull at the seams and let biology and rhetoric do their fiercest work. Aristophanes will tease and attack with comedy's hooked laughter. Roman tragedians will take his high-temperature scenes and pour them into lines polished for chambers rather than hillsides. But the structure Aeschylus designs, action that is also adjudication, spectacle that is also sermon, music that is also municipal ritual, keeps reappearing. Shakespeare turns a battlefield into a debate about honor, a bedroom into a hearing about evidence. Racine converts passion into law. Ibsen and O'Neill bring families to the dock. Every truth commission that offers victims a public stage and then asks the nation to watch with patience is performing the Eumenides with microphones. Every court that allows victim impact statements is negotiating with the Furies. Even the ethics of leadership gleaned from his pages feel modern in their severity. Do not sacrifice what you most love to expedience and call a duty. Do not step on purple unless you are ready to bleed. Do not organize your fear into empire and call it destiny. Do not forget that the dead remain political and that unburied grievances are not quiet just because you close the door. If you are a city, do not write laws that humiliate old powers. Invite them to serve and feed them if you want them to bless you. If you are a soldier, know that victory must be taught manners. If you are an artist, trust that your devices can bear meaning if you do not let them become toys. Because he is so early, later readers sometimes imagine him primitive. But the surviving seven show an imagination that loves experiment. He writes the only extant tragedy about a contemporary event and stages the enemy's grief. He writes a play that is almost all chorus and makes it hinge on a civic decision. He writes a chain of three plays that invent the jurisprudence of a city out of the psychology of a family. He probably wrote a whole trilogy about a god in chains, then, if the ancient guesses are right, ended it not with defiance, but with an accord that teaches rulers to bend. Within those experiments, he keeps spectators oriented by rhythm and image. The result is not a museum of origins. It is a repertoire you can stage today and find your neighbors thinking harder than they plan to. It is fitting that his epitaph mentions Marathon and not his poems. He knew that art requires peace, or at least a pause, and that someone must buy that pause with daring. He also knew better than most artists what the pause is for, to organize grief into meaning and meaning into policy. His tragedies do not flatter soldiers. They honor their wounds by refusing to let war's thinking govern the city at home. In the Persians, he teaches victorious Athenians to see. In the Orestia, he teaches them to vote. The plays are liturgies of responsibility. And yet, quiet within the bronze-struck language, there are silences braided with tenderness. The guard on the roof, sick with waiting, watching for a flame that means homecoming. Electra at a tomb, tracing the edge of a curl of hair. Orestes hesitating at a doorway because the person inside is, before all politics, his mother. Cassandra pausing on the threshold not because she doubts the truth, but because she would like, one time, to be believed. A queen who, after a decade of governance and grief, still remembers the weight of an infant and uses that memory as both shield and spear. A chorus, old men with tired knees, who cannot run upstairs anymore but can still count the beats in a word like justice. A city, seated in sun, that understands it has been shown not gods but itself enlarged to god size so that flaws and chances can be measured without lying. If you want a final measure, think of the two different kinds of noise he trusted. There is the stamping, ululating chorus that enters, the shout that binds a crowd into one body. And there is the careful rhythm of litigants speaking in turn while others wait, and then the rustle of ballots as stones are dropped into jars. He loved the first for its power to gather. He loved the second for its power to decide. Between the two stands tragedy, part him, part hearing. He spent his life calibrating the ratio so that neither would devour the other. A city that forgets the first becomes thin. A city that forgets the second becomes savage. Aeschylus held them both and taught his neighbors to do the same. He is therefore not simply the father of tragedy, a title too patriarchal and singular for the work. He is the architect who discovered that stories could carry law, the farmer who realized that justice is soil, the soldier who wrote the cost of pride into choruses, the citizen who imagined a home for anger under the hill. When we say that theater can make a people, we are repeating his thesis. When we sit among strangers and feel ourselves for an hour part of a larger mind, we are experiencing his invention. When we leave the room and treat verdicts as rituals rather than as mere outcomes, we are living his hope. You do not need to believe in Zeus to recognize the rightness of his designs. You need only to have lived with other people and to have learned, perhaps the hard way, that homes and nations are arguments that must be sung before they can be settled. If you are building a series about beginnings and forms, start with him, because he shows what beginnings are for. He begins dialogues that do not end, institutions that can be repaired, metaphors that carry, roles that stretch actors and audiences toward adulthood. After him, Sophocles can refine the art's poise. Euripides can interrogate its myths. Comedians can mock its pretensions. But the room they all use, the public space where a city studies its conscience aloud, has his blueprints pinned under glass. He made drama a fact in the life of a democracy, and in doing so, he made democracy a little more dramatic in the best sense, alert to spectacle, allergic to cruelty, ready to transform injury into speech. That is why the chorus still stamps in us when we hear certain news. That is why we whisper furies when rage seems older than we are. He gave us names and forms for our storms, and then taught us how to bring them under a roof.